Hi, everybody. This is Kel Weinhold from The Professor Is In. In light of the current COVID crisis, we're teaming up with Himalaya to show our support. So that means from April 1st through the end of May, Himalaya is going to match the exact dollar amount for every active subscriber to our premium and channel and donate it to direct relief to support our healthcare workers. So if you've been putting off joining the premium channel, please go to your app store, download the Himalaya app, search for The Professor Is In, and subscribe. And together we can help take some of the burden off of our healthcare workers in this time. Thanks a lot.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to The Professor Is In podcast. I am Dr. Karen Kelski, and as always, I am so happy that you're here with us today.
And I am Kel Weinhold, and I'm happy that you're here too. And I also hope that you come and join us in our various social media platforms at Facebook at The Professor Is In, on Twitter at Professor Is In, no the, and on the blog at theprofessorisin.com, where we have daily content from us, from experts, from people out there living the academic life. It's a great place to come and get information. So we hope you join us there.
Indeed. You know, The Professor Is In has been going on since 2011. And just as Kel just mentioned, we have a lot of platforms and also a book.
And, oh, I forgot the book. Sorry.
Yeah. And the thing
sitting
is,
right here in front of me.
The thing is about all those platforms is that they have, what I, in terms of creating them or in the back in the day or putting content up now, felt pretty confident about them and why we had them and what their purpose was and how they would engage listeners or readers. But the thing about the podcast is that I have felt really uncertain about the podcast. I really enjoy it. I love it. But I never really, for one thing, I don't listen to podcasts. I am not an auditory learner. I can't really tolerate people talking at me.
Me included.
Especially partner and children in particular. And no, I just can't. I can't take in information that way. Although the one exception is on long road trips, I can listen to them then, but in the car. But that's it. So I don't have a great sense of the podcast. And so I've realized as time has gone by that I have a ton of insecurity about it. Mm-hmm. But I bring this up just to say, I don't know, just to share that in the interests of sort of sharing and vulnerability. And also to say that in the last couple weeks, I've gotten, I don't know about you and your circles, but I have gotten a bunch of emails and messages on Facebook and so on saying that people really like the podcast. And that really means a lot to me. I really, I'm like, really? You do?
You're Sally Fields of podcast.
you like me. You really like me. And then I'm like, what do you like about it? And people share things like, I don't know. I mean, I guess in a way people share different things. But right now in the pandemic, I think a lot of people are saying that they just feel less alone because we are much more isolated. We're not seeing one another, even though we have Zoom contact. We're just not seeing each other the way we did. So anyway, I don't know why I just went off on that except to say that I'm just glad. I'm glad to get the feedback. And as always, if there's anything that you want from our podcast and you want us to talk about, let us know.
Absolutely. So one of the dilemmas in that, and we've talked about it on the last couple of podcasts, is that, you know, we had this whole arc written out about what we were going to do.
Yes, we did.
We had all these podcasts.
Best laid plans.
And a friend of mine texted me today and said, hey, I just listened to the Productivity Pyramid podcast. She said, I laughed out loud with the last line. Next week, we'll talk about how to plan for 2020.
Oh, God.
And I was like, oh. She said, no, I learned a lot of things besides that, but I just thought it was so funny. And I thought, it is. And at the same time, it was, first of all, it was really poignant. And it was just this like, oh, right. The hubris. We said, we'll plan for 2020. But it also got me thinking about how one of the things that can happen, and I see it in myself, and I see it in the clients that I'm talking to, is there can be this freezing in place. Like, I can't imagine what it's going to be like. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, I'm just going to either keep diligently working on the things I'm working on, mm-hmm. as if there is not all this going on.
Right, as if things were normal.
Or I'm going to be a deer in headlights and just freeze in place because it's so frightening. And I think both of those are completely legible responses.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe a version of the second that sort of disassociate and stare blankly out the window for hours at a time because you're incapacitated.
Right. And I run these things with Unstuck. I think I mentioned them on the last session that I do these called Writing in the Pandemic, and people come and just do a work session. And, you know, every once in a while, it'll bubble up that someone will be just like, I just can't figure out why I'm doing this. That's what I can't figure out, especially about grading. Can you imagine? We hated grading before. Now when you go, oh, why am I doing grading? So we wanted to talk a little bit today about how to think about what comes next. And part of this is based on the post that you just did about people, maybe it was just a tweet that I read, but I know it was based on a Chronicle article where you said we need to be entrepreneurial in our thinking. And then I saw a tweet come across that was, you know, no matter your ranking, you need to be thinking about something else.
Yeah, it was my last column for the Chronicle.
Oh.
And the final paragraph basically said, it walked through what different types of people, categories of people in the academy need to be thinking about. But at the end, it said, every single person from grad students up to tenured faculty need to be thinking entrepreneurially about income streams mm-hmm. that may be able to carry you over some lean patches where you are unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
You'll lose your funding. And even tenured faculty can lose their jobs when universities declare financial exigency. And I think that that's going to start happening at an absolutely unprecedented rate.
And so when I read that, I thought about, you know, classic of us, right? You're giving people the hard truth. And I think it is a hard truth. And at the same time, I think when I read that line, my brain froze. And I am an incredibly, you know, entrepreneurial, mm-hmm. nimble thinker and
yeah.
literally just froze in place thinking, what? Would that be? And mm-hmm. I thought, okay, how about if we unpack that a little bit and talk about it a little bit and
sure.
and just like give people a little bit of room to start practices mm-hmm. that give that space? Because I know you really want to talk about the slowing your mind practices and the ways that you figured out to just detach from
mm-hmm.
like the overthinking.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. so maybe we could start with like ways to detach and then we can talk about ways to let ideas in and the ways we get tangled up in trying to grow. For me, I want to talk about how we get tangled up running out and trying to grab things out of fear.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, before getting into those specifics, I mean, sort of as framing, you know, good ideas and creative thinking and entrepreneurial thinking. But let's just take the word entrepreneurial away because I think that's quite a terrifying word yeah. for most academics.
And they're not entrepreneurial thinkers,
well,
typically.
Well, we are. Academics are very entrepreneurial. That's actually one of the core tenets of my post-academic advising. It's just that the entrepreneurship. So let me actually talk about that because I think it matters
okay.
and it's empowering,
okay.
I think.
Okay.
But if you first of all, you figure out that there's a thing you want to do and you figure out that there are grad programs that enable you to do it and you apply to them and you get in. And then you're in a grad program and then let's say you get through the master's into the PhD and you have to propose a project and you come up with a project that no one's ever thought of before. And then you defend it and you legitimize it with, you know, research. And then it gets passed, and then you do it, and then you write it, and you're also seeking funding for it. All of those things are incredibly entrepreneurial,
right.
and they're marshaling tons of resources from different areas that a lot of folks are totally unaware of. Like, you know, your typical support networks, like your family, is probably like, they have, what are you talking about? Like, that's ridiculous. That will never work. And you're like, no, it'll work. And sure enough, because you did the research and you figured it out, you made this thing work. So there's a ton of entrepreneurialism in the academic career. It's just that we never frame it that way. We frame it as apprenticeship and this very dependent relationship, the hierarchical relationship on these systems, these structures, and these people who advise you and so on. But you can just as easily switch that around and say the systems are only in place to allow you to be entrepreneurial.
Oh, and I think that's really interesting when you think about switching it around, because it also has to do with the lens you look at it through, right? So I've always thought of faculty as sort of the most risk averse,
oh,
the people who want to get in a rut and stay in it.
100%.
Which is the sort of the anti-entrepreneurial idea, right? Because basically, you know, being an entrepreneur is working 60 hours a week so you don't have to work 40 for somebody else. You know, you just do anything not to be in a system, and the PhD trains you into the system. So I do think that there's a struggle right there for people who are thinking about how am I supposed to do this differently, because they have been aiming for a structure and a system and a known quantity,
predictability.
Right? Predictability. I'm going to get in this track, tenure track, and I'm going to stay in the track, and it's going to deposit me at the end
with a healthy retirement account accolades. For sure. No, I don't deny that at all. It's just, and it is a little bit about who we're talking about. If someone has been in the academy for 30 years, they are deeply entrenched.
Right.
It's Whereas someone who is still in grad school or a new PhD, there, it is a little bit easier, I think, to, it's not, and I'm not at all saying that people didn't go into it looking for structure and predictability. I think most people did. But I just want, I really, this is really important to me to tease out all of the entrepreneurial accomplishments that are involved in academic research.
And I really appreciate that complication of it. To really say, okay, you can go ahead and have the story be told this, but the reality is from the minute you started, you've been bucking one thing or another.
Yeah.
You've been pushing for one thing and another. You've been being really creative in your thinking. Mm-hmm. If we think about all the conflicts that people ever have with their advisors and everyone else, it's when they want to do it their way and somebody tries to do it another way, or they're trying to shove them this direction or that. So there is a particular fierceness and entrepreneurial spirit that I do think gets undersold. So I appreciate that a lot.
But that was all a digression, because where I was really going with that was to say that none of us, so it was because I was going to say, let's not use the word entrepreneurial, then proceeded to discuss
use it repeatedly
for 20 minutes. Classic academic move.
It was only a couple minutes.
But humans don't think good creative and entrepreneurial and original thoughts under stress. And we are all under tremendous stress. And this isn't a podcast episode devoted to telling you to stop being under stress, because that's impossible. But there are ways to squeeze out a few moments here and there to lower your stress, potentially down to a level where parts of your brain can begin to operate again that will allow you, allow original thoughts to emerge. And it's very much, in my opinion, and I know in the work that you do, that this is not conscious thought per se. This is not where you're logicking your way through a problem.
No.
This is actually settling your mind through doing repetitive, non-intellectual activities, so that you're kind of your subconscious really bubbles up with new original inspiration that would you, that you couldn't get from your classic cognitive thinking modes. And so that's just really important to open up space for that, for your subconscious to bubble up some original thoughts. It's already probably doing that at night when you're sleeping with all kinds of crazy shit like I'm having every night, certainly, but that's one thing. But dreams are one thing, but this is in your waking hours. So anyway, that's why that was our motivation in talking about it. So I don't know if you want to say more about that before I talk about some of the things I find useful.
Well, first of all, I was just thinking about that's the problem, is that it's so hard to make that time for those things to bubble up. And I talk to this about to writers all the time, is that when's the last really great idea you had staring at your computer with your eyes watering, like reparting your hair 15 different ways while staring at the screen? You don't. But you do have really good ideas when you're in the shower, or you're taking a walk, or you know, you're washing the dishes. Suddenly it all starts to pop into place. And I think that the challenge right now is that we have such a background hum of stress and noise that we can't even figure out where it's coming from. I was talking to my brother yesterday, who was saying that, you know, he said, I'm not an irritable person. I don't get irritated with the world. And he said, I'm living with a low level irritation that I'm reactive, that I'm so, and then he went off on a political analysis of why he's so angry. But what I realized is that even that, even his saying, you know, his fury at what he sees happening at the federal level, then playing into his inability to keep that irritation measured or at a measured level or gone is what we have to deal with. As we talk about this for the next 30 minutes, really people continuing to sort of stick a pin in the fact that we understand that the hum is there. So we're not saying you're going to get to Zen level of calm, but it's there. So now what? How can we lower it enough that those ideas might be able to trickle in, that you might be able to stop staring in the mirror screaming, what am I going to do? Because whoever answered a question with the like,
clutching your head,
clutching your head screaming.
The source of all great ideas.
Well, there's this really interesting thing about productivity that they say that you need stress to be productive, that there is a good stress. There's a thing called a good stress. It's that motivation. It's a deadline. It's the thing that...
Necessity is the mother of invention.
Right. It's got that little thing at the back of your neck that's got, I got to do this. And then there's a point at which stress flips over and it becomes your adversary and it freezes you. So I think a lot of people are already tipped over the edge we're, how do we get back to a tolerable level of stress for even a few minutes a day to let
those ideas, which is all we're talking about.
Which is all we're talking about.
Because it's impossible. And certainly one of the shared narratives I've seen on social media and among our friends is that this is a minute by minute proposition and that you could carve out 10 minutes of relative peace and then at the end of the 10 minutes go spiraling back into, you know, outrage, fear, depression. And so that, and that's normal. And so that's all, so I just want to acknowledge that's totally normal. So this is all about just carving out the 10 minutes or whatever. But anyway, so yeah, I have just been thinking a lot about the things that I do. So just as a jumping off point, I started, it was interesting, some of you may know, you probably don't, podcast listeners probably don't know this, but one of my loves for the last couple of years has been doing these little handicraft kits that I get from Japan, that are made in Japan, that are building tiny, tiny replicas of traditional Japanese architecture with incredible detail and accuracy. And I found them on a, found one on a trip to Japan, and I bought it on a whim, brought it home, and made it, and fell completely head over heels in love. And of course, it's all in Japanese, and it's not just in Japanese; it's in handwritten Japanese, because why not? Because so it's handwritten instructions with hand sketched diagrams. You know, it's just spectacularly painstaking, exhausting, exhaustive, and time consuming. So what was interesting is when the pandemic started, I always keep a few of them in the house so that I always know I have a wand I can start. And I got it out and I started trying to do it and I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't make sense of the Japanese. I couldn't make sense of the diagrams. I just wanted to scream and hurl it across the room. And, but I didn't. I said, okay, all right, clearly this is demanding more cognitive power than I currently have at my disposal. So I just stuck it in a box and put it away. And then I was like, well, what can I do? And I had been seeing all over Instagram, which is constantly marketing stuff to me, that paint by numbers is a thing. And so I finally just broke down. And you and I ordered them at the same time, right?
No, I ordered them a couple of weeks before.
Well, I know.
You did.
I mean, were we talking about them at the same time, or was it just coincidental?
I think it's
that
coincidental.
We ended up, Instagram markets to both of us.
Right. Well, they are Instagram markets to both of us because the only Facebook page we use is yours. So,
anyway, so I got a. Actually, I still don't have my paint by numbers because then the companies got so slammed by people like me that now I'm still waiting, 6 weeks later for it to come. But I wanted to share my process because the first attempt at finding a relaxation was not right. And I was just let it go. And I found something that takes even less cognitive. I mean, there's no cognitive, none. Paint by numbers, they give you the brushes, they give you the canvas, they give you the paints.
And the numbers.
And you do, and you just simply, all you have to do is get a cup of water to wet the paintbrush with, and then you just start filling in. And it is the most soothing thing I've ever done in my life. I turn my brain off. There is absolutely no decisions to be made, and therefore there is no decision fatigue. It's just you tell me where to put it in and I put it in. The only evaluation I have is have had is that I discovered that the brushes they include aren't very high quality and aren't really good enough to get into the tiny spots the way, as tiny as the spots are. So I went and got better brushes from an art supply store. And also then I discovered that there's some variation in the quality of the paint and whether it will actually cover the numbers or not. So sometimes you paint it in and then you can still see number 7 underneath the paint, and that's not very nice. So then that has to be dealt with. Which, by the way, for any of you who do paint by numbers, get a white colored pencil and pencil over the number and then paint, and then the number won't show through.
Because we need to make it a perfectionist thing. But what the thing I wanted to add there is that I had purchased several paint by numbers of some of my favorite pieces of artwork, thinking, oh, this will just be perfect. And I got it and started working on it, and I couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. That it made my eyes hurt. It made my head hurt. It's too precise. Mm-hmm. And so the reason I brought that up and what I interrupted Karen earlier about is that I think it's important to pay attention to that line she said, which is you might have to play around to find the thing that shuts off your brain. Mm-hmm. It, you know, I have found that television doesn't. As a friend of mine said yesterday, you know, I don't need a bunch of emotion thrown at me right now. It's like I can't handle people on television yelling or crying or even just being interactive. It's right. Like I cannot process all this stuff.
Plus, I get furious when I watch modern day TV. I am addicted to the series, the Netflix series, The Last Kingdom, which is about the Dark Ages, British Dark Ages, and Prince Alfred and Northumbria and everything. And I just love it. So I turn that on. And I do my paint by numbers. And that is my ritual every night. And the kids come out and they laugh at me. And they're like, oh, there you are, watching the Dark Ages, doing your paint by numbers. And I just love it. And I look forward to it all day. But my point, sorry, that was
and you do have one.
I do have one. That was a huge digression. But what was I going to say? Oh, I get so when I watch modern day stuff, I get kind of angry, infuriated about what are you doing outside? Why are you touching each other? And then I just go into yet another, the place of rage that I live in all day long, of that fucker in the White House is the reason we're in this place we are. And then I'm not relaxed at all.
Right. So the longer, the really short point in that really long talking thing is find the thing that helps you step away. Not the thing that numbs you, right? So everybody's got all their numbing devices, but what is a way that you can just feel the entire system start to unwind? And I think a lot of the mechanisms that we trained for, you know, for those people who are practiced at yoga or meditation or any kind of mindfulness practice, that's hard work right now. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of talking about a little different thing than just like go to your sort of centering practice, but rather where's a place that you can shut off your cognitive work for a little bit that you can start to imagine. So that's mm-hmm. the first step in this is where can you find that? For some people, it's gardening. For mm-hmm. some people, it's mm-hmm. I'm going to make a little potted plant on my deck because that's all I have in my windowsill because that's what I have. Or I'm going to start knitting. Or I'm going to start crocheting, something that just mm-hmm. occupies you without having to make a decision. I think that's mm-hmm. where patterns like, you know, I think that's why people get into knitting and crochet mm-hmm. and why painting and everything mm-hmm. else. Because there's a paint by numbers. I mean, mm-hmm. there's no decision making.
Well, I think for some folks, art is some art has that quality yeah. and not yeah. just, I mean, in other words, for myself, and I know this because I ran the jewelry business for a while where I monetized crafting that right. I love to do, that for me, I'm not able to do artistic work that requires judgment, right. artistic judgment, right. and have it be relaxing. And right. and but some people, I think, can. I did want to say one other thing that has operated like this for me for a very long time, for a number of years now, but it's actually makeup. Doing makeup, it's incredibly ritualized and gradual, and it involves many, 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 many steps and kind of technical skill that develops over time. And there's a tiny little bit of experimentation involved. If you like, oh, today I want to try a new, you know, color palette, but it's totally optional. And it also sends me into the same. Mm-hmm. You know what, though? I do want to say I'm not necessarily clear on the distinction between numbing and calming, because I think the paint by numbers for me is numbing. And I don't know that that's a
bad
thing.
I was thinking more of the ways that are harmful. I was thinking like more drinking. Of like drinking sure. or other kinds of things that are just escape. And they're, mm-hmm. you know, I know it's a thin line, right? What's the difference between escaping with paint by numbers? Mm-hmm. Escaping with paint by numbers at the end of the night, you're not less healthy. You're not haven't done damage to your system. For you haven't sure. done damage to your goal for yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have, and I think it's really important not to be in a whole bunch of judgment about what we eat or what exercise we do or don't do. And everybody's got to find their own path. Mm. And if you're, the things you're doing are making you wake up with shame or right. making you go to bed feeling like you are even further down than you started.
Right.
That's the difference of what I'm looking like. You don't go to bed because you get obsessed with your colors, your paint by numbers, but you don't go to bed thinking, oh, I shouldn't have done that. That right. was, that's really off. I feel really bad part, about yeah. my choices.
I mean, might, sometimes with sleeping, a little bit about in terms of my sleeping patterns, right, a little right. bit, but yeah, no, I hear what you're and saying. That's what so I'm that's a good distinction. Right.
So to do the reason I'm pushing toward all of that and really thinking about that space is to then be able to have enough room to listen. And I don't mean when you're doing the paint by numbers, right? I'm not saying, well, give yourself this question while you're doing this relaxation. That's not what
that's
I mean.
That's the opposite
it's
of what
the
we're
opposite
saying.
Of what we mean.
You give yourself an assignment. You are not turning off your right. cognitive brain.
But when we get enough air in there, mm-hmm. you know, can we then start to, when we can reclaim that little moment the next day, when we can think, oh, wow, my paint by numbers, that was so nice. And the whole system relaxes for a second. Can we start inserting little questions, right? So we tend to insert big questions. What am I going to do if there are no jobs next year? And that's terrifying. Mm-hmm. If we start asking, what do I want to do today that reflects how I want it to be tomorrow? What are the practices I can put into play that are going to create the system that I want later? Instead mm-hmm. of trying to create the system, mm-hmm. create the little steps, do the little things. So I was talking with a group of people the other day about grading. And we were having a really interesting discussion about why do people hate grading so much? Mm-hmm. And there was a real question of cost-benefit analysis, the time you put into it versus what students and you get out of it. It's a perfect place to begin quietly start asking yourself, how could my assessment of students be different when this is over? Right. So that's an example staying in the system, mm-hmm. but it's the little kinds of questions you can start to ask instead of like, how do I redo this assignment? So it's like, stop, start with the small questions. Mm-hmm. What do I want out of this? Mm-hmm. What do I want out of assessment? What do I want the student to get out of it? What do I want them to get from it? You can do those same questions for yourself. What do I want? Mm-hmm. What do I want my day to look like? If I know that global pandemics are probably not going to just, this is not going to be over in February. I mean, sorry, not February, September. Mm-hmm. What I want to start, what things do I want to start doing to mm-hmm. make a difference in the outcome for me, which mm-hmm. I think is the epitome of entrepreneurial thinking. Mm-hmm. Entrepreneurial thinking is there's a problem. Mm-hmm. What's a different way to solve that problem? Mm-hmm. And yeah.
I had a thought while you were talking, and it feels a little random, but I'm going to put it out there because maybe it isn't. I had the thought that sometimes the thing that you can do that pushes your mind off of its typical scarcity, panic, instrumentalizing track is when you do things for someone else. Uh-huh. And that sometimes, and I was thinking actually about The Professor Is In, and that it started when I did have a job. It was a part-time job at University of Oregon McNair Scholars Program. And I was paid so little. It was practically a volunteer job. But I poured my heart and soul into it because I believed in it so much. And I still do. I still believe in the McNair program. And it was really the insight that came. It was really a giving. It was a really sort of a giving thing. It was like, oh my God, these poor babies are like lambs to the slaughter. I have to help them. I have to help them. They're being groomed to go into PhD programs and to think they're going to have an academic career, and they're brilliant, and they might, but they don't understand what they're getting into. And so, my focus shifted on how can I help?
Right.
How can I help?
Right.
And I feel like that the professor's in as an idea was born from that moment of, oh, wow, like that, you know, oh, look at this thing I'm doing. Wow, this is a pretty interesting thing. Maybe I could do something with this. So right. I don't know. Anyway, that was just me off the cuff thinking that sometimes when you do something for someone else, it takes you away from the instrumentalizing careerist motivation.
Right.
And the thing is, the instrumentalizing careerist motivations have ground to a halt with this stupid pandemic.
Right. I was doing a yoga thing with Jason Crandall today. He's on Yoga Glow, and I adore him because he is so comfortable with making mistakes. Hmm. He's very, very good. And he's like, oh, yeah. Do you ever notice when you do a whole bunch of this and then you go into a bounce ball, you should tip out of it? Because I do. But the whole yoga thing is a breathing for stress. So he was having you do these repeated movements and breaths with it. It was to reduce stress, because that's what I was looking for this morning. But in the middle of it, instead of the classic sun salutation, you know, like this, mm-hmm. over lean, chaturanga, mm-hmm. up dog, down, mm-hmm. down dog, you know, he disrupted the flow of it. So it was a like semi-salutation. I mean, he disrupted it. Mm-hmm. He said, we're so used to down dog, chaturanga, mm-hmm. this to that, that we actually can just, we don't stop and breathe and actually rewire the stress. Mm-hmm. The stress just keeps going because we don't have to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been thinking so much about that today as we were coming to this podcast, is thinking, where can we disrupt our patterning
mm-hmm.
to just do it slightly differently so it clicks us out and makes us rethink it a little bit.
Because it can be such a small thing.
Right. And it gets to that. It gets to that Finding Your Own North Star by Martha Beck, who's a PhD out of Harvard, PhD in sociology out of Harvard. She talks about it as trying to pay attention to your essential self. She says, I mean, her whole argument is that, you know, you have your socialized self, the thing that all the behaviors that you took on to socially fit. Mm-hmm. And then you have your essential self, which I'm sure as an anthropologist, you're like...
Well, like 14 different fields are now freaking out and shouting.
All right. So listen, she's not talking about essentialist, right? She's not saying you're essentially this. She's saying like your socialized self is... avoidance-based, right? Mm-hmm. We're avoiding critique. Yeah. We're avoiding all these things,
that's
right?
That's true, yeah.
And that your essential self is attraction-based. You mm-hmm. want to move towards the things that inherently are you're attracted to,
that.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? So I'm not saying you're essentially this or that, all right? So, and we have all these behaviors we take on to fit in our social milieu, right? Mm-hmm. So you know, we don't want conflict. We want to conform, because you and I have talked about how people don't want to be pushed out, right? Mm-hmm. They don't want to be shamed out.
Mm-hmm.
They imitate, mm-hmm. right? All that stuff. So she says there's that self, right? And then there's the other part of you that's attraction-based, that's inventive, that's unique, that is all of those things that is trying to exist
mm-hmm.
and get squished or not squished.
Find expression and...
Right. It actually is playful,
mm-hmm.
right? Spontaneous. All those things. So anyway, in Finding Your Own North Star, she talks about the tension between those two and that, mm-hmm. that it always exists.
Mm-hmm.
But attending to that other self, that mm-hmm. spontaneous, if we can get that to bubble up, we can see the things that are going to be more, motivate us more, make us mm-hmm. enjoy what we do more. And mm-hmm. it can be within the job we have. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not arguing you have to go somewhere else. It's within what you do. How do you keep trying to find that? And that's really the point I wanted to get across today, is taking this idea that Karen's talking about of finding just a little bit of air in all of this, of taking your mind off of it for a while, of releasing that down a little bit, that in a way, the relaxation thing you find is a little bit closer to that playful, whatever it is that is you, that you. You know, everybody don't at me about all these words she's using, okay? It's a really interesting book.
It is. I like it. I recommend it quite a bit to my coaching clients.
That and Steering by Starlight. Mm-hmm. But really trying to let those things bubble up. And I feel like I feel a little uncomfortable about this particular podcast session because I feel like we keep using the same words over and over. Like we're not quite
like what?
You know, like find space, let it up. Mm-hmm. Is it entrepreneurial? Like are we just using definitions to define, using the word to define itself? But I just really want to encourage you all to find whatever air you can.
Yeah.
To try to think about what do you want it to look like?
Right.
And start making the tiny things to make that happen.
Right.
And the tiny thing can start with find the thing that you can escape into.
Right. Right.
And let that be the beginning of the wheel turning.
Yeah. I guess what I want to add to that is, and this is, I think this will not, we don't need to go there today because in a way it harkens back to earlier episodes, but this is also a grief moment.
Oh, God.
And so in terms of what do you want it to look like? Well, you wouldn't have to reimagine your future if your future, the future you had planned for wasn't crumbling around you.
Right.
So, and so in no way, shape, or form are you or I saying that this is a neutral space of imagination.
Mm-mm.
It is a space of imagination that is accompanied by very deep grief and mm-hmm. fear. Mm-hmm. And so that's like I just want to, you know, I just want to give a little shout out to that. We had pulled out Pema Chodron's Start Where You Are when we were talking about today's episode, and part of the very first chapter of that is talks about her mission in the talk and in the book, that chapter and in the book of the practice is to lean into the uncomfortable. And it actually, it's amazing. It works amazingly well with Martha Beck because she says that we love the comfortable and the pleasurable and we grab onto that and we hold onto it. And then we sit there and we're worried it's going to stop or go away. And we're very greedy about it. But then the stuff that's uncomfortable and unpleasant, we spend a ton of most of our energy pushing it down, pushing mm-hmm. it away. Mm-hmm. And denying it and rejecting it and disavowing it. And she says, you know, that her principle here, not just hers, of course, but Buddhism in general, is leaning into it and allowing that discomfort to be your starting place and to be, to make friends with it. And so this is opening up, obviously, this is Buddhism and needs more than what I can provide in the last 5 minutes of this episode, but I guess I just, that might be a way to look, to approach this moment that we've been talking about, which is, yeah, this is incredibly unpleasant. Nobody's saying it isn't. It's very fearful. It's very uncertain. Don't run away from it. Don't deny it or shove it down or push it down with, you know, and with all of those other things. What were you doing? Numbing, with the numbing things. You're going to be numbing part of the time. That's totally fine. I'm numbing much of the time. In fact, I just realized today I literally carry around in my purse a bag of Easter candy. Like I have an emergency bag of Easter candy now because I don't know when I'm going to need emergency Easter candy.
I think that's the definition of numbing. I'm going to go with the definition.
Yeah. So like we all are doing the numbing and it's fine. But yeah, just that idea that with some practice and so on, that just because something's scary and unpleasant doesn't mean it's dangerous and unsafe, and that you can sit there and even with the stuff we've been talking about, like the paint by numbers or whatever, from that space of acceptance, new ideas will come up.
Yes, I'm going to leave you with this because this is what it reminds me of.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of Leonard Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me of his song Anthem. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.